Okay, I'm going to give you a toxic tour of East Chicago today, and that will include right now a little bit of a presentation on its history and the cultural, context that you're sitting in relative to Chicago, because what happens here is absolutely dependent on where Chicago is and what it has been. And so we have legacies, and also we're part of the future development of Chicago. And I think what makes that really important is that to Chicago, to the Chicago market, which is about 7 million people on the Illinois side, we're a black hole to their consciousness, and yet we're like the closed closet door that they don't know that supplies them. We're most of the about the NIMBY effect, not in my backyard. This is not in their political backyard. It pushes it right out to the southern shores of Lake Michigan, outside of Illinois entirely, but it's completely dependent on Chicago. And a good example of that is that, like I said, Chicago metropolitan area is 7 million people. That's larger than the entire population of Indiana. So when you're looking at the political map, you're looking at that influence over what's happened on the Indiana side. It has a tremendous amount of influence. What I hope to do is to make this no longer a black hole. I want to shine a light onto this area. Because what happens in a black hole, a lot of things that you don't want to know happen in a black hole, where you've just kind of shoved things off. And right now I'm trying to open that, bring a light to it, to the Chicago market, because I think it's the behavior of that market that determines what happens down here, much more than what happens down here determines what happens down here. I think we're all very much a part of it. I'm going to give you a little bit of a geological history, what this region is in terms of the glacial activities. But right now, in the industrial age, what makes this important right now and through the last century is that this was considered the work shop of America. That's what this region considered themselves, and that's what Chicago considered the south side of Chicago. And this is what's called the Calumet Industrial Corridor. It's a bi-state corridor that goes from the south side, southeast side, where you've been, where the Petcoke issues on the Calumet River, and extends all the way down here to the southern shores of Lake Michigan. Now, if you remember in the 1950s, Indiana wanted to extend its industrial base all the way across its shoreline. Right now, we have about 40 miles of lakefront exposure in Indiana, of Lake Michigan. About 27 miles of it in the 1950s was an industrial corridor. They wanted to extend it all the way to the Michigan border and put steel mills all the way across. It took a congressman from Illinois, Congressman Douglas, to stop that and to preserve what was called the National Shoreline. This area and this region considers themselves the workshop of America, the southern shores, the industrial corridor, the Calumet Industrial Corridor. And that extends from the Calumet River area, southeast environment, southeast neighborhood, Hagwish, all the way down through here, through Whiting, East Chicago, Gary, and it began to expand east all the way to the Michigan border. In the 1950s, Congressman Douglas from Illinois stopped that expansion by designating the National Shoreline, the Indiana Dunes National Shoreline, National Park. To this day, Indiana considers that a federal taking of land from the people. They still fight those battles. Now, they don't consider that industry was going to take it. They don't even think about that. They just know that the federal government took it from them. So what ended up happening in the 1950s is that you started having that expansion then. So in a compromise, they developed an area, Portage, just east of Gary, where they started developing more steel mills. You had Bethlehem Steel and et cetera right over there. To build those, they had to plow down the dunes. Well, most of this area were dunes and swale. This area, the southern shores of Lake Michigan, were considered the Everglades of the North. It's the fourth most biodiverse region in the United States. There was lots of natural areas right here. Prior to the industrialization, this was kind of the hunting grounds and the summer homes of people in Chicago, the wealthy people on the north side. And that was kind of its heritage until it became an industrial heritage. Now, people consider that there was nothing here until industry was here. That's the argument. The industry made this place. Well, industry, in a sense, it annexed properties and it created cities. And I'll get a little bit of that history. When they built portage, the mills, Bethlehem Steel and stuff like that, the plow down the dunes, they took that sand and they built the peninsula out Northwestern University. So Northwestern University, when it wanted to expand in, because it was landlocked because of it, where its position was, they can expand out to the lake a little bit. Mm-hmm. They barged the sand over there and filled it in so they can expand into the lake and build their lagoon area out there. So there are connections, the constant, you know, exploitive connections and stuff like that. Now, in the earlier part of the industrial and steel history, they used to have the steel mills on the northern side of Lake Michigan, where the resources were, where the limestone and the ore was. What they then started doing in the late 19th century is they brought the mills down here. They shipped the resources down to the southern side of Lake Michigan, and this is where they manufactured raw materials for the steelmaking process. So this area continues to see itself as the workshop of America. What they see in the last 40 years is a downgrading, a shrinking of the steel industry. But in fact, if you've watched steel production over years, steel has continued to produce exponentially over the years. So a good example is in the 1970s, East Chicago had employed about 70,000 people in steel and steel-related industries. Today, it employs less than 3,500. So in terms of employment, it has gone down. But in terms of steel production, it's gone up. Today, this region is considered the most productive steel region in the world. And it's right here. One of the things to recognize what happened when they built out these communities. Let me see if I get the regional here. What we have here are these industrial fiefdoms on the southern shores of Lake Michigan. In Whiting, you had Standard Oil, which founded Whiting, basically, in 1895. In East Chicago, we had Inland Steel, which founded basically East Chicago in 1893. That's an interesting number because that's the date of the World's Fair. So when you had Pullman bringing people down to Pullman from the World's Fair to give them a tour of his industrial utopia, you had the same sort of opportunities for investment. That's where they brought a lot of investment banks from England to invest in the southern shores of Lake Michigan. That was the time they were able to show them this land and say, hey, that we can expand industry in the United States right here. And so then you had in Gary, you had U.S. Steel that founded Gary. And for a long time, these corporations, these industries, controlled and operated the cities. It wasn't until the decoupling in the 1970s of the fortunes of industry and the fortunes of the community that paternal relationship started to be severed. Although the people here still operate as if industry is their parent, they still have those alliances, that behavior. They expect industry to help them. But industry, again and again, has continued to fail them over and over and over again. And what we have now recently is just the continuation of privatization of all our assets. We're seeing lots of that happen. The industries like here in East Chicago, Inland Steel, funded enormous, wonderful library systems. You had the Carnegie Libraries. You had two mm-hmm. Carnegie Libraries here, wonderful systems. We had Jens Jensen, who designed the parks. We had really quite a beautiful urban pattern, neighborhoods and things that were developed. I think there wasn't a concerted effort to solve some of the earlier problems they had with worker housing and stuff like that. And when I bring you through Marktown, you'll see that as an example in 1917 to develop another working housing development plan. So there were lots of concerted efforts to put the best minds of the time to industrialize and bring housing, community, and industry together. There were ideas of Garden City concepts coming out of England, Ebenezer Howard, that they were relying on and stuff like that. So there were some concerted efforts. What you've seen through the 20th century, however, is an encroachment on those original plans. There's this idea that we in America that we have an idea and we build on it, good ideas. We stand on our parents' shoulder and we build out greater ideas. What happened was the inverse, is we had the industrial encroachment of those original plans. Instead of making better plans, we've just destroyed and went after the original plans. And so what they found out with worker organizations, workers organizing, is that they were able to go home and organize. And so what eventually what they started to do is they started to use industry to control urban planning to sever the neighborhoods. And so today, Chicago has 14 separate neighborhoods that are severed by industry, whether it's infrastructure or actual industry, where before they were more, it was more a unified community. There are so many different strategies where encroachment is occurring, and you'll see that in Marktown, where now Marktown is completely engulfed by industry all the way around, where original plans were not to be that in that case. So we're on the southern shores of Lake Michigan. We're part of the Great Lakes water basin. What's significant about that is that the Great Lakes is 20% of the world's surface water. 84% of North America's surface fresh water is right here. And we're right there on the shores of it. There are nearly 30 million, more than 30 million people that live in this water basin. And there's about a $7 billion fishing industry, or had been. That is starting to fall apart. We're seeing, I think, in Lake Michigan, that almost completely has fallen apart. You can see a population distribution around Chicago is the most intense usage. Indiana shoreline, again, with the glaciers receding, it left this amazingly biodiverse region. What makes this area so amazingly biodiverse is we actually have elements of the Northeast, the Northwest, the Southeast and Southwest all converging right in this area. And that's what creates an amazing opportunity for diversity. A lot of it is the glacial receding, and it's created this enormous marshlands, dunes and swales. And so we have these lot of bogs. These are really wonderful environments for plant life and stuff like that. That's one thing that we're just shocked by in our backyard and our garden is the growth here. It's just enormous and fast. It's just shocking us.
And is that biodiversity persist now?
Yes, you still have
that
it.
Range, I mean, not the same range, but.
Well, you have the attempts to preserve the dunes, mm-hmm. And you'll see if you go and get a tour over there, you'll see a lot of it there, mm-hmm. And you all have the Kankakee River, that area that really sets the borders. It's really the Kankakee River and north of that. It kind of mimics the curve of Lake Michigan. So during the industrialization and post-industrial, when we started to characterize our impacts, our industrial impacts, the EPA came up with what was considered 43 areas of concern where we've had enormous industrial impacts on the Great Lakes water basin. And on the bottom of it, Lake Michigan is East Chicago, and East Chicago is the greatest. Of all of the 43 areas of concern, East Chicago is number one in terms of issues, and I'll explain that. What you're looking at here is the Grand Calumet River and Indian Harbor Shipping Canal. This is the only place on the Great Lake that fails every measurable benefit. But the way in which they characterize areas of concern is by beneficial uses, and there are 14 metrics, and it's the only region. Only what they call area of concern that fails all 14 beneficial uses. And a good example is 90% of the water is wastewater from industry or community, residential. There are 150 leaking underground water or oil tanks in this region. There are 15 combined sewer overflows, 423 hazardous waste sites in this water basin, in this area. 11 waste disposal storage facilities, and 5 Superfund sites right here in that area. So if you look across Lake Michigan, almost 3/4 of Lake Michigan in Indiana is industrial. Because we preserved the lakefront in the dunes, nearly a fourth of our lakefront exposure is parkland. Otherwise, it's residential and commercial. So what we have is almost a completely industrial gated community along our southern shores, mm-hmm. of Lake Michigan. And I'm going to give you some exposure to that. This is a picture I took on the breakwater at the Hammond Marina, and it just outlines all the industries that you can see from there, starting with the Chicago skyline, State Line generating plant, which is now closed, You have Cargill, Unilever, BP, ArcelorMittal, and U.S. Steel along those shores. ArcelorMittal, about 4 or 5 years ago, they came out and bought up most of the steel properties along our lakefronts. ArcelorMittal is the largest steel company in the entire world, yeah. And by buying the steel products here, Inland Steel, what was called LTV, and Bethlehem Steel, they have here in East Chicago the largest integrated steel plant in the world right here in East Chicago.
Is that ArcelorMittal?
ArcelorMittal. Here's a map of East Chicago, black and white. Here they do the whole steel production cycle, all the way from raw materials to creating galvanized steel or maybe stainless steel rolls or whatever it might be. So it's a completely, you're going to see a good image of that. Here's a map of East Chicago. This gives you an idea. 80% of East Chicago is zoned industrial, so everything in purple here is industrial land. We're sitting right here right now in this area here. Now, East Chicago has a heritage being called the Twin Cities. There's the East Chicago side and the harbor side. Right now, you're sitting in the harbor. We've crossed over the Indiana Shipping Canal and come over to here into the harbor. This side is called the East Chicago side, that side of the canal. And there are different cultural differences between the two sides. A few years ago, I did an environmental impact study on the land use here. This is mostly ArcelorMittal up here. The red is the highest impacts. We have several industries that have grown here. Steel and chemical companies. Dow was here for a while. The company had bought them, Dover. There's a list that came out about 3 years ago. I think it was in the New York Times, of the top 101 most dangerous chemical facilities in America, and two of those reside in East Chicago. Several of them would be on the Gulf Coast, yeah. And if one of those would blow up, the entire Chicago metropolitan area would probably go with it. They're that dangerous. I added the air releases. In 2011, East Chicago Industries released 18 million pounds of toxins into the air. There are 3,041 counties in America. 3,041. We are right now, East Chicago is in Lake County, Indiana. Lake County, Indiana ranks number 9th in the nation in terms of toxic releases in the air, and that's entirely attributed to BP, ArcelorMittal, and U.S. Steel, all of which reside right in East Chicago, right on its border. So they're right here. It's concentrated right here. Here's what's called the Indian Harbor Shipping Canal. I used to be the director of the Indian Harbor Shipping Canal, and you can see the steel industry on either side. Now I have another presentation. I'll put this presentation online, and you can see it at any time and use it and take from it. In the 1960s, late 1960s, this is what it looked like. This is a picture from the EPA. The Grand Calumet River, what the oil industry used to do is to filter out its system with the water and just filter it right back in. You'll see today that it continues to bubble up oil and stuff. Now, Indiana, understand its relationship to water, and is that Indiana discharges 1/3 more toxins, industrial toxins, into its waterways than any other state in the Union. So Indiana discharges 27 million pounds of industrial toxins, known toxins, into its waterways. The second greatest violator is Virginia, which discharges 18 million pounds. Illinois discharges 8.8 million pounds. In fact, Indiana discharges more than the next 10 states combined. So where Indiana has a population of 6.8 million people, those other 10 states combined represent 100 million people. So the disproportion in terms of our environmental regime, we're very relaxed here, our environmental regime. In fact, our superintendent of what's called IDEM, Indiana Department of Environmental Management, used to be the plant manager for Bethlehem Steel. Mm.
And what are they putting into Lake Michigan or the
all of its waterways?
All the waterways.
Yeah, it's discharged. In terms,
don't they drain in this industrial area? Don't they drain to the lake?
Yes, some of them. Yes, in terms of the Calumet River, it drains right into the lake. And that's another, when you're talking about the invasive species issues and going up the Calumet River and where they have the barriers there, the electrical fence, the barriers and stuff like that, what they don't tell you is that the Little Cal links right into that before the barriers. So those fish can go right around those barriers and come up the Grand Cal into the Indiana Shipping Canal and out to Lake Michigan. There are no barriers. So it links right into the Calumet River through this system up through that. It's funny. And so you hear about all the work that they've done on the Illinois side to stop in terms of the Calumet River, but they don't tell you that there are other rivers that link into it that come right around the system, and there are no barriers. Although there are a lot of industrial pollutants, so by the time they get out of the system, maybe they've got three eyes or something like that. In East Chicago, we have a beach called George Beach. It's considered the most contaminated beach in the Great Lakes. Most beach closings. It's the third most contaminated beach in the country. And this, I put this on here because this kind of gives you a sense of what people are in the post-industrial age. I would have said this. I posted this before the post-industrial age. On the Illinois side, what you see is a pure post-industrial landscape. You see fallow brown fields, and they're trying to look for new uses, reuses, and they're fighting most reindustrialization projects, the Petco piles right now. They're fighting that because they have other uses that they have plans for those lands. They have the Millennium Fund that looks to repurpose a lot of those lands adjacent to the Calumet. Well, if you look up the Millennium Fund and stuff like that, and you have in Pullman, which links up to Pullman, which they're looking to create a national park out of, and then there's the Lakeside Project, which is very similar to what's on our side in terms of an old industrial steel mill, U.S. Steel, in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But here, what you're seeing on the Indiana side is a reindustrialization scenario. So a good example of that is the BP project and the tar sands project. That's a nearly $5 billion project. It's the largest private investment in Indiana's history. And so what you're seeing on this side is a reindustrialization, a recommitment to industrialization. And what happened, what's significant about that is that we're in a different era. This is no longer the 1880s or the 1890s. It's no longer even in the 1970s when we wrote the Clean Water and Clean Air Acts and started the EPA. This is a chance to recast our industrial footprint with a whole different paradigm to meet our future needs, our present needs. And what we're doing, what's happened, is that these projects have been shoved through and grandfathered in into an old environmental regime. And an example of that is with the BP plant, and I can get into more of this, is that that was a nearly $5 billion investment to construct basically a brand new plant. But that was done under what was called a maintenance project. They were able to define that as a maintenance project. And so what they didn't have to do is get risk assessments. They didn't have to do in terms of labor. They didn't have to, because it wasn't considered new construction. They were just maintenance construction. They had different rules and regulations on how labor was to be related and utilized. And the same thing with the environment. So anyhow, to give you an understanding, in the last 40 years, I think this gives you an understanding of what people here, the workforce here, thinks. It says, oh Lord, I know I've been forever changed by the conflict between these two lies. Being immersed in the mill, I become like the steel I work, cold, hard, sharp, heavy, dirty, bent, flawed, and rusting. Yet through others' eyes, I'm useful, durable, and to an extent, even valuable. I think that's been the real challenge today, is what can we do next? And right now, what people are being faced with is a reindustrialization scenario. The problem with that is, with the BP plant, with other projects, is they're being promised jobs. There are almost no jobs for this population here. Most of those jobs will go to people in Illinois, probably, for many reasons, either because of educational reasons or where they operate. I'm going to skip this. These are two women that are working in Marktown, and I'm going to get back to that in a second. So I'm going to shoot through a bunch of things about the oil industry. You've seen some of this. What we see now is, you saw that Whiting used to be an oil town. East Chicago used to be a steel town. The Whiting refinery, what was used to be Standard Oil, which is now BP, is expanding right now. They're at the last stages of their project, this nearly $5 billion project, most of which occurred in East Chicago. So they moved a lot of that project into East Chicago. The mayor of Whiting used to be an employee. He's a retired employee of BP. The last time Whiting had given BP a tax abatement or an incentive, BP declared it prematurely obsolete, so that when they were suddenly needed to put the project on the tax rolls, they didn't have to. So he didn't want to get that Whiting in that same problem. East Chicago, on the other hand, thinking that they needed anything, gave BP a tax incentive, $165 million tax break that won't come to the community. And that is a community in... If you think about, especially some of the neighboring communities, East Chicago has some of the poorest neighborhoods in the entire state of Indiana, and some in the country. And so you have some of the poorest people, the poorest community, giving this one of the wealthiest industries an amazing tax break. So anyhow, to understand oil, to understand the oil equation and the oil arguments, I didn't understand any of this until BP came here. Now, at the time, I was part of the kind of official, you know, I was an official, a leadership official in the community. I was the executive director of the Indiana Harbor Shipping Canal. I was doing a comprehensive plan for the East Chicago. I was involved in a lot of different things. And so when the BP project came and it didn't make any sense, I started working to try to make sense out of it and offer proposals that would make sense, which kind of pushed me to the outside. And it also forced me to try to understand what was going on with our energy policy, and what was this new industry doing in East Chicago? What was that industry? And then it brought me to understanding what were the tar sands? What was our energy policy? And it just made me learn more and more. So to understand where we are, just understand, is that 40% of the world's oil supplies 40% of the world's commercial uses. Oil is an amazing, light sweet crude is an amazing energy source in terms of concentrated energy. It supplies 98% of the world's transportation energy. So we're so dependent on this resource right now. And to give you an understanding of the concentration, one tank of gas equates to 2 years of manual labor. That's the kind of energy source there is. And if you look on Exxon, they have this great little ad right now talk about equating 1 gallon of gas to 3,000 hours of energy for your smartphone. So where people are used to having to plug in their smartphones every day to recharge, 1 gallon of energy in terms of its concentration energy is enough to supply energy to a smartphone for 3,000 hours. So that's like 100 days, I think, right? So you can understand why this country got a little bit, or any country, is going to be fighting and create an oil state like we've created. Now, in terms of oil supply, we all have heard about peak oil. Light sweet crude is dropping off. If you see on this, it's really dark, but this light blue line here, that is the tar sands. So people, what we've done is we've moved a lot of projects to tar sands. But the tar sands does not equate to much of our oil portfolio. It's giving us a boost, but it's not going to give us much of a boost. And if we continue on our needs, our present usage, we're going to need a whole lot more than what we have at this point. So give you an understanding, the return on investment. In the 1930s, one barrel of oil produced 100 barrels in return, so that energy return on energy investment. So it was one barrel invested to produce 100 barrels in return. That was the light sweet crude that we got out of Texas. That was in the 1930s. Today, it's one barrel investment to produce 17 barrels in return. Now that's all the our energy portfolios of where we get our oil from all over combined together, aggregated together. The tar sands by itself is one barrel investment to produce 4 or 5 barrels in return. So you're seeing an extraordinary energy inefficiency going on, and we're now moving more and more to the tar sands. And this is something that people, I'm going to skip this one. This gives you an understanding of where we've gone with it. But to put it in context with all the other energy sources, light sweet crude in the 1930s, one barrel investment to 100 in return. Coal, reason why we're hooked on coal a little bit, one barrel investment for 80 barrels in return, basically, in terms of joules, in this case, one joule. And hydroelectric, one barrel, basically, one joule investment for 30 joules in return. Wind, which has now become pretty efficient, one barrel, 20 barrels in return, or one joule to produce 20 joules in return. That's better than where the U.S. oil is today, when you combine all of ours. Nuclear is one barrel to produce 10 in return. What people don't realize is that solar is one barrel to produce, or one joule to produce only 9 or 10 joules in return. Solar is, as an energy source is not quite there yet. It's growing though. We expect it to grow higher. Tar sands is 1 to 4. Corn is 1 to 1. It's basically a subsidy. So in terms of those economists, energy economists, to sustain this society, civilization, in its complexity now, we need a 1 to 10 investment, one joule investment to boost 10 in return. So anything below that won't sustain this society as we know it in terms of our energy use. There have to be changes that will have to occur. So even solar needs to be improved. It doesn't need to be improved much more to get above that, but solar needs to be improved. All right. So that gives you an understanding.
So can I just, to be absolutely clear, that means that we spend a barrel of energy to get back 100.
Exactly.
Or 4.
Exactly.
Okay.
Or you can think of it in joules or calories.
And is a barrel roughly a joule?
No.
Oh, I see.
No.
It's just two different ways of measuring.
Yeah, two.
Okay.
What's most important is the ratio, exactly.
Right.
So if you haven't gotten a tar sands 101 lecture, I'm going to give you a really quick one. I'm going to race through some of the things that I did. All right, the tar sands, what we saw in the early 2000s, we shifted from light sweet crude in Saudi Arabia to a reliance on tar sands. And that is coming out of Canada. Basically what it is at this moment, there's two ways in which we get tar sands. One is like mountaintop removal. The other is in situ. It's like fracking. It's a fracking system. So the mountaintop removal, where we're basically taking out the land and then squeezing out the oil out of the sand, that has a project area of the size of Florida. And that is occurring in the Great Boreal Forest, the largest carbon sink in the world. So what we're doing is we're taking that carbon sink out of use. In terms of the in situ, we're now, in tar sands, they're beginning to go towards in situ. The project area is much larger, and like fracking, very, very destructive. I'm not going to get into the fracking, although those two issues are very much linked. So what you have is the Great Boreal Forest and then what we call productive use. And that's what we're doing now to the land. So I wish I had a big screen to put it on. So this is what we're doing to the land, the size of Florida. We're just tearing the land up.
Alberta?
Yeah, this is Alberta. This is up by Fort McMurray. So what they're also creating is some of the largest tailing ponds that we're beginning to see from satellite photos. Very large toxic ponds, because what they have to do is they have to use fresh water to filter out the bubble, to boil out the oil out of the tar sands. And I'll give you an example. These are some of the large tailing ponds that they're producing. Some of the air, the impacts on the air. Now, one of the things that we know is that although Canada signed the Kyoto Agreement, they haven't abided by it. And they're surpassing their caps enormously. But still, what they're doing is they're shipping this stuff down here because they've surpassed their caps, their carbon caps. And they're shipping it down here to refine or to get it to market. This is actually in Whiting. All right, so what they're getting out of the land is they're getting bitumen, this tar-like solid. And what they need to do is they need to convert that to a more viscous product so they can pipe it down, pipe it through the through pipelines through the through this country. And so what they're doing is that they're getting lighter, sweeter crude to mix it with, or they're getting what they're called condensate from the fracking process. And so they mix it in with that, and they're able to pipe it down here. And
question. So the water from that's used for fracking, they've been taking that and using it to liquefy the bitumen?
No, what they're doing is they're taking the natural gas. Sometimes the natural gas or the light sweet crude that they're getting out of the process, they're piping it up there to mix with it. What they might be using in the process, in the creating this process from bitumen to dilbit, they need fresh water to boil out some of the oils. And so they might be using some of that fracking fluid for that. I'm not positive about that. But I do know that they do have a cycle of reuse now that they're using. Before, they were using just fresh water. About a year ago, they decided to recycle some of that fresh water into the process. So once they use it, they're trying to use it again and again. The industry is trying to clean up their act, but they've made so many errors. They have created such a massive problem to begin with. So to flow through the pipeline, bitumen is thinned with lighter petroleum products called dilute. Dilute is either a light sweet crude, or it's synthetic crude, or it's a natural gas condensate from the fracking process. Early on, when they are first sending this stuff down here by pipeline, toluene and benzene was one of the things that they were diluting it with most of the time. Now it's an array of product. You're seeing much more different uses. Now benzene they had a lot of it because they weren't able to use it for much. And I'll give you some of the tour of here.
Because it's been restricted so much.
Yeah, but now they have so much product. And so right now we have this huge network of pipelines going through the country, through the tar sands. You know about the Keystone Pipeline, 900,000 barrels a day. They didn't get the northern expansion approved, but they got the southern expansion approved. Then you have Enbridge, which is doing an end run around the Keystone Pipeline and building the largest network of tar sands pipeline in the country, up to 2.5 million gallons or barrels a day that they can redistribute. The main line is coming out. It's called the Alberta Clipper. Right now they're in phase two of expanding that. The idea is if activists and others can squeeze the spigot at the top where it's coming out, coming down, we can have a lot of downstream effects. So in phase two, they're coming out for comments in the next couple of weeks, and that'd be something that we can try to restrict that. In the U.S. It's going from Alberta to Superior, Wisconsin. Near Duluth. And so Superior, Wisconsin is kind of the center place right now for many, many, many issues. And so what they did is they expanded the pipeline. Now what they're doing is in the phase two is they're increasing the pressure on the pipeline so they can pump more of it through. And so we can perhaps have an impact there. From there, coming down from Superior, Wisconsin, down to the Chicago area. Chicago is enormously important to this. Our three pipelines right now coming down. It's the 14, the 61, and the 60, or the 6A. And they're going to be building another pipeline going going back up. It's going to send dilute, once they bring the diluted dilbit down here to refine at BP, they're going to send the dilute back up so it can be reused. So they're going to build a new pipeline for that. There's also a pipeline that goes across the northern side of Lake Michigan. It's called this the 5, Line 5. And that goes right through the Mackinac Strait, which they've now found. They did a, they went down there and looked at it and found broken supports. Now, that's a pipeline that wasn't ever used before for tar sands. It was light sweet crude. And so now it's a 57-year-old pipeline that they're going to repurpose for tar sands. Tar sands is a much more, it's a heavier product. It's more abrasive. It's hotter when it goes through the pipe. And it's corrosive. It's high sulfur. We also discovered recently that it's explosive. So that's a major concern. You have what's called the 6B, which comes from down Griffith, Indiana, just south of here. Takes from the 6A. And it goes out to Sarnia, Ontario. And if you remember a few years ago, the 6B is what broke in the Kalamazoo River. This is what I considered the clarion call. This is the first project that, this is the first major spill. It's a million gallons that spilled of tar sands. At the time that it spilled, nobody really knew about tar sands. In fact, Enbridge didn't even have it on its registers that it was tar sands, that it was dilbit. They expected it to behave like regular crude, but in this case, it went to the bottom. The condensate volatilized, but the tar went down to the bottom, so they've had lots of different problems in trying to clean up this thing. It became a huge, huge issue. It's a highly toxic material again, and we've discovered a lot of the impacts in terms of what's happening. So this occurred in 2010, the same time that the BP oil spill had occurred. So we didn't hear much about this. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you didn't have people running in here cleaning up birds and saving animals and stuff. What you had is Enbridge buying up properties and covering up and hiding what was going on, because they didn't know that this was, people didn't know at the time that there was something different about this. It was tar sands. It wasn't light sweet crude. What occurred here is that there was a break. The pressure went down. They were up in Edmonton, in Alberta, the people that are controlling the pipelines. They saw on their instruments that the pressure went down. So what they decided to do is they increased the pressure, thinking something was wrong. It went down again. They increased it again. It went down again. It took them, I think, 36 hours before they discovered it was actually a break in the... So they are just pumping more and more in. So now there's also a pipeline that probably is under-identified at this point, and that's called the Southern Access Extension, which comes from Chicagoland area, actually Lockport, all the way down, or it's called Flanagan, all the way down to Patoka. And then from Patoka, it's going to go down to the Gulf through what's called the Eastern Gulf Crude Access, which is a natural gas line pipeline that they're going to repurpose for this in reverse. This is really quite interesting because in Illinois, it's Enbridge tried to utilize eminent domain for this construction. They failed. There are 14 landowners apparently that are withholding, they're fighting this, and the ICC, Illinois Commerce Commission, which can approve eminent domain, rejected it. This past summer, Enbridge requested again the use of eminent domain. So we're hoping to be able to fight that.
On what grounds did they reject it?
I'm not certain at this point. I don't think anybody understands what really went on.
And so that Southern Access Extension is not operating
right now? It's not operating right now. If they go on schedule, it'll be 2015 that'll go into commit. But it's not even permitted. It's not even permitted.
That's constructing.
No, they're not constructing it right now. It's not even permitted. It's one thing we can stop, we can get ahead of. Now, there's the Flanagan South, which goes from Flanagan out to Cushing, Oklahoma, which is already permitted. What's significant about that project is just like the southern extension of the Keystone, that project was fast-tracked. The reason that they were able to fast-track those two projects is because they are on existing easements. So they're just running them on existing easements, and they're using what's called the Nationwide Permit 12, which is an odd permitting tool that they're using that is for local utilities, so that they don't have to do impact statements on the environment or anything like that. This is a way to fast track it. So that's something to fight their use of the nationwide permit 12. It's a really significant fight, I think. This is the Flanagan South as it's going in right now. And in the last 3 years, there have been an array of big disasters all the way through from Alberta all the way through here in this area. In fact, Enbridge in the last 10 years, has had 804 oil spills. And there are some, I haven't updated this. You had the Mayflower spill in Arkansas this past year, which the Pegasus pipeline spilled 300,000 gallons. They have now since torn down the homes. Now, with the capacity of pipelines being constrained, they're now shipping these things via rail. And so, if you remember around Chicago, the Canadian National bought up a major spur right around Chicago, which comes right here. Along with that, we're seeing other disasters. In Lac Mégantic, Quebec, this past summer, 72 tankers lost their brakes and crashed into the city center, killing 47 people. And that's when we discovered that tar sands is pretty explosive. Mm-hmm. Now, in Superior, Wisconsin, they're looking to they're seeking permitting to be able to barge tar sands on the Great Lakes. So for the first time, they're going to use what's called Highway H2O. They're going to convert it to Highway H2 oil and ship it. What's significant is the Alliance for the Great Lakes study on it has the Indian Harbor Shipping Canal on the cover of the study. There are 26 refineries in the Midwest that are supplied by these pipelines, tar sands. 72% of tar sands is refined in the Midwest. It isn't on the East Coast or the West Coast yet. A lot of this is the pipelines don't reach out to the East Coast at this point, although they're getting what's called the Line 9, which is to come across. Canada has been fighting it. It's come across the northern, north side of the Great Lakes to come across to this area.
They turn it into dilbit up at the site. And yeah. then it still has to be refined.
Yes, and then it still has to be refined down here. A lot of the pipelines in the west are intended to get it to market. They're not utilizing much of the refineries in the Gulf for tar sands either. They're mostly using to get the tar sands to the international market. So that's the Keystone Pipeline. That's the southern extension that we saw here, was to get it to the Gulf so that it can be shipped to international markets. That being, you know, Brazil, Mexico, China, India.
As crude or finished product?
No, as tar sands to be refined there. So we're utilizing the refining capacity in the Midwest to supply our domestic needs. Tar sands is expected to triple in capacity in the next 15 years.
But that won't change that ratio.
It's not going to change the ratio much because our needs are going to be greater. And so now I'm going to get really quickly to what's going on here in this region, in East Chicago, BP. What's significant about BP and the BP project is that it is the first major tar sands project in America, and it's one of the largest in terms of retooling a refinery. It's a nearly $5 billion project. It is to refine 410,000 barrels a day. When that facility goes online in full swing, which is going to be in this January, February, it's going to change the energy market entirely. The landscape is going to change overnight the moment that goes online. It outstrips any other refinery in terms of its capacity. It's just amazingly large.
Is there a connection between what's happening here and what's happening on Chicago's south side with new highways and new... Are they expecting that area to be revitalized because of the BP plan?
Part of that is yes. Also, I can get into that a little bit. And a lot of that has to do with Rahm Emanuel. Also to understand is that nearly 10% of the nation's asphalt comes from this plant, is produced from this plant. So when people want to talk about taxes and gasoline that go to making roads, they're also talking about that money going to, you know, it also goes to the oil industry again, you know. So when people like to make this comparison of what profit an oil company gets compared to the amount of taxes. Well, a lot of that tax money also goes back to the oil company to build the roads and various other things.
And what are the vast differences? You said it's going to be operational just January, February.
Right. Right now, BP is about 43% blend of tar sands to light sweet crude. By January, by the end of January and February, they expect to be at 90 to 95%. That's their goal. Of tar sands. And that's going to change the market overnight in terms of the viability of tar sands. You're going to see a major, major change. It's going to put more of that online.
And so it'll shift our dependence.
There are some studies, though, and I can tell you about that in New York Times about 3 weeks ago. They expect there's going to be a capping out. There's a synthetic light sweet crude that the Saudis are developing that should be coming online in about 5 years that they think we're going to go back to this light sweet crude, the synthetic stuff from Saudi Arabia. It's a synthetic process.
It's petroleum based.
Yeah.
But it's just getting it to light sweet.
Right. Mm-hmm. So they think that they're going to go back to Saudi in about 5 years. So I don't know where that is yet, and I have to investigate that
and
a little
prices?
Bit more. I don't know much about that right now. I saw this article.
High in order to make the tar sands
right.
With this knowledge and all of the money and investment they're putting into this, and they know that then they're going to go back.
Well, they didn't know this. They didn't know this until recently. The Saudis have just developed this process and stuff like that. So this is some leading indicators. We're just beginning to hear this. In terms of that argument, the way in which I like to... we have a choice where we're at right now when it comes to tar sands. And the choice is, are we going to go and invest so much more in the late stages of fossil fuel that are so destructive?
Right.
Or else are we going to do what I think is the more difficult thing? Is you saw my energy graph. Are we going to find more... we're going to put our energy and intellectual energy capacity into building out other alternatives. That's going to be a harder task, but those are the choices we have right now. Anyhow, BP has a footprint about 1,400 acres, same size as downtown Chicago, the Loop. Again, it's in the fourth most biodiverse region in the country where BP is sitting. This is a map of BP, and I can go into a lot of this on the lakeshore. It has the largest distillation tower in the world, a capacity of 410,000 barrels a day. It has the second largest coker in the world, and that's when you started to see the petcoke piles showing up in southeast neighborhoods on the Calumet River, on the shores of the Calumet River this past couple months. That has gone online. Right now it's at full capacity, and that can produce 2.2 million tons of petcoke a year. Petcoke is basically a residue of the refining process. Basically, it's from any heavy crude. You get this residue, and tar sands clearly a heavy crude. Mm-hmm. It's a heavy sour crude. And so there is this residue. You might consider a byproduct, but it's a commodity. It's a high energy fuel commodity, which is, again, being shipped to India, China, and elsewhere. Now, it's high carbon. It's a very, very dirty product. We mix it. Sometimes we used to do a lot more mixing with coal for our coal fire plants because it was a high energy resource and a low cost because it was basically a byproduct of the oil industry. So if there was great demand for producing gasoline and oil, they would have more of this petcoke, and they needed to distribute it, so it was a low cost alternative to coal. But it's a high carbon. It's a much higher carbon. So what we have is we've got these petcoke piles showing up on the south side of Chicago. The idea right now is you've got Beamsterbor, which is now, you had Beamsterbor and the Koch brothers on the south side of Chicago distributing the petcoke. But they're getting it not just from BP. They're getting it from Lamont, the Citgo plant in Lamont, Illinois. They're also getting it from the Exxon plant in Joliet. There are two other tar sands refineries in our region. They're not nearly as large as BP. The Citgo plant only produces about 100,000 barrels a day, 130,000 barrels a day, compared to 400,000 BP. So right now, we got an injunction against Beamsterbor. State discovered that Beast Boer, being one of the two players handling the pet coke, has been doing it without a permit. So they stepped out of the market and shipped off all their pet coke, and it just leaves the Koch brothers right now as a major player.
And they have a permit.
They have a permit for doing it. They've invested about $10 million for a water system to suppress dust. The city of Chicago is now looking, in Illinois, looking at requiring them to enclose it if they're going to continue to handle pet coke. The issue really is, if they're not going to do it there, where are they going to ship it to? Where's it going to go? Who's going to be handling it? And stuff like that. We don't have any answers to that at this point. But that image there and this image show you the adjacency to neighborhoods. You can see playing fields, parks right next to it. Huge area. And this is what we saw during the summer of it blowing around the area. We saw this ourselves. And I didn't take a picture of it, unfortunately. All right, and BP is also threatening Marktown. This area around BP is a heavily industrial, a lot of brownfields, but they've decided that they are going to go and bulldoze Marktown, that they think that they need a parking lot, I think it is, that they've decided. Now, what's significant about Marktown is about 400 people live in Marktown. Many of them live there generation after generation. Industry has encroached closer and closer and made it pretty much impossible to live there, unfortunately. And a lot of people bring out the argument right now, why would anybody want to live there? They shouldn't be allowed to live there anymore because it's, you know, known environmentals. The fact is they lived there before the environmentals impacted them. And the industry in this project, BP, the reason that I think that they are looking to plow down Marktown is their environmental liability. They know they're going to impact them. The fact should be that we shouldn't allow them to have done this right across the street from a neighborhood. That's the real argument. That's the thing that we shouldn't allow to happen. Right now, people inverse the argument and put that they don't belong there. And you're going to see how landlocked the area is. Here's an image of Marktown. Overview, here's BP right across the street. Here's through Marktown to the coking unit. You can see it right at the end of the street. Some other pictures of Marktown, just some of the residents. Marktown was designed in 1917 by Howard Van Doren Shaw, who was kind of an eclectic architect of the wealthy in Chicago. Ragdale, if you ever heard mm-hmm. Ragdale, mm-hmm. that's Howard Van Doren Shaw's home. Mm-hmm. Marktown was designed right after Ragdale. He designed Lake Forest's downtown, which had become the model for walkable communities. This is based on Ebenezer Howard's designs, Garden City concept. And this image here is every year I participate in a bike tour from Pullman to Marktown, from one utopian industrial village to another. I talk about all the issues on the Indiana side. But now they have an existential threat. They're trying to grapple with it, and they've decided this past year they met the residents of Marktown and decide they're going to try to fight BP. After that, they had hoped that activists and people would come out. They were on the Tribune. They were all over. Nobody has come out to help them, not an attorney, nobody. And so they're really now frustrated a little bit. BP has now been buying up properties that were on the tax rolls that were for back taxes that haven't been keeping up. The median home value in Marktown is $18,000. These are people that are pretty poverty-stricken. Most of the homes in neighborhoods adjacent to the industry are about
that. Where do those people work?
Geez, some of them work within industries and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Also, the Indian Harbor Shipping Canal goes through here. BP impacts that, being the most contaminated body of water in America. I was president of redevelopment, and we developed what's called a Marktown revitalization plan. We hired Bauer Latoza, which did the Marquette plan for the Marquette Park, and Gary did the UIC expansion into Pilsen, did the water tower cleanup, fix up in Chicago, and we hired them to help us with a plan for revitalizing Marktown. And that was in conjunction, we developed, if you're familiar with Chicago, they have the Burnham Plan. Burnham is a metropolis plan, a whole region plan. And what we did is we developed what we called the Marquette plan. And that was to dovetail into the Burnham plan and recapture the uses along our lakefront and to try to find where opportunities were to break open that industrial gated community. And in doing that, we developed a corridor of that were brownfields that led right to Marktown that we can open up. And then so Marktown can be linked right back into the into our neighborhood system and into our lakefront. And then we hired Bauer Latoza to develop a plan for Marktown, a revitalization plan that would dovetail into the Marquette plan, our lakefront plan. All of that has been thrown out because of the BP investment. And so that's where we are at now. A lot of planning, a lot of what the community had wanted. At the time, I was doing a comprehensive plan for the city. Right when BP announced, the city excused me from all, because I came out against BP, I lost all official positions, and BP and industry got a chance to rewrite the comprehensive plan in East Chicago, which completely rewrote the Marquette plan here, what's called the sub-area plan for East Chicago, and for a re-industrialization scenario. So they completely wiped out what we were looking to do in terms of creating multiple uses.
But it's so amazing because it's like, you know, the argument is jobs, but these things don't bring jobs. It's all automated, right?
No. And again, you look at the steel industry in terms of what jobs were lost.
Totally.
Well, what that's left us with is a community where about 28% of African American males are unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
About 18% of Hispanic males are unemployed. East Chicago is mostly African American and Hispanic. There's very few ethnic whites left in East Chicago. We're very rare here. What the government has done over time is they hired on a lot of the unemployed, and so we got a government employees that were we had a bloated workforce in government here for quite a while. Now with the constraints on the budget and various things, the mayor has now been letting go a lot of the employees, selling off public assets and stuff like that. So now we haven't really solved the problem for the employment base here. Projects like BP don't increase it. Although one of the things that happened while during the construction phase, I stayed a little bit silent because that meant construction jobs around here. For the construction mm-hmm. industry and stuff like that. But now that the construction phase is over, you know, I don't mind us just shutting it down. It's not going to mean much. And in terms of what we've learned between since 2007 to today in terms of the global impacts of fossil fuels is enormous. And so I think what we understood back then, we probably shouldn't have been planning for a fossil fuel investment. What I developed and what really got me into trouble when they proposed the BP plan, and being a planner, I developed what was called a FAR equation. In Chicago, in terms of towers, there's an equation that they developed that for a building to go up high, they must supply public space at the base. The higher they go up, the more public space they must supply. And what I did with the fossil fuel industry in this investment, BP's expansion, was the more of an investment in fossil fuels meant they had to commit more to alternative development, manufacturing here on that land. And so I built out an equation that would require them, if they were going to put more additional investment in fossil fuel, they would have to put additional investment in alternative. At that time, they were the biggest player in wind energy. But they decided they were going to go a different way, and they sold off all their wind assets. And they just came at me. I got attacked. I got fired from every public position I had and let go. And they rewrote all the plans. They rewrote the Marquette plan. And then they cleaned up behind them. They got rid of the mayor. I was in a lot of these backdoor. You know when they talk about backdoor negotiations? I was in those meetings where industry was was deciding what was going to happen on public lands and things that were going to happen. And the way in which they did is they negotiated everything they wanted under the table. I didn't realize that the oil industry was exempt from a lot of the banking regulations. So they didn't have to report monies that were they were giving under the table. You know, you see monies going under the table, say that's illegal, you know, especially to public officials. Now, on the public official side, it's illegal. But it wasn't illegal until recently.
Well, there's the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that governs bribes to officials to promote business activities, but that doesn't, there's no equivalent.
Right. Well, there was a lot of those kinds of things going on. And
no, under the table, you mean bribes?
Of sorts, yeah. There were lots of promises and lots of things going on and lots of decisions on public lands and public assets that they were doing. And what they ended up doing is I got a little upset with a lot of this and started talking about things. And the mayor was in these meetings and stuff like that. And so the way in which they cleaned up their act was they just had the mayor indicted. He's in federal prison. You know, the mayor was sloppy. And he wasn't fighting for the community, unfortunately. But they can negotiate with him, get what they want, and then they can indict him. Get him out of the picture.
Can you talk about good governance, which you mentioned?
One of the things that happens, it's kind of the MO of the industry, is that when they're going to come in and make a major investment, what they do is they come first with a good government initiative. And they did that here for several... good government initiative. Mm-hmm. And so what they do is they fund studies and programs and training and get... And basically, at first, for several years, we had this good government initiative here. We didn't know who the funder was. It was through the congressman's office. But we couldn't find out the funder. He wouldn't supply us who was the funder. It wasn't until the late stages that we discovered it was BP was funding the Good Government Initiative. And that allowed them to reach out into the region and understand the political framework that they're playing in and then recast that framework to their benefit because they're going to be making a major investment. Now, you don't have a $1 billion industry here and... you know, run the roulette table on a local election. That doesn't happen. You don't have that kind of investment dependent on a local election. You make those local elections are going to turn out to your benefit. Mm-hmm. You're going to make that happen because you're not going to put $1 billion down and then have it just turn, you know, the city turn their back on it. One of the things that occurred here is that you've got a $5 million investment in the tech center for Purdue. You've got, I have it right here, you have a $5 million investment for the Millennium Park Bridge, the BP Bridge in Millennium Park. You have another $2 million for the lagoon in Lincoln Park. You cast out your money elsewhere. When Rahm Emanuel, let me give you an understanding. When we approve BP, IDEM, Indiana Department of Environmental Management, approved IDEM's application for its water discharge, its NDPES permit. We did so in violation of the Clean Water Act. Clear violations, but we approved it. Not even marking that it was in violation. It wasn't even known to the rest of the world until it showed up on the front page of the Tribune. Rahm Emanuel immediately stepped forward, utilized that to step forward, and he got 1 million signatures through the Chicago Park District, used the Chicago Park District to collect 1 million signatures against BP. What happened was you had the Alliance for the Great Lakes step forward to negotiate with BP on this. They'd been legally given this water permit. What people didn't realize was the founder and head of the Alliance for the Great Lakes was Lee Botts. Resides here in Miller. She ran for the water district, Chicago, and lost that race and came over here. She got on. She founded the Alliance for the Great Lakes, and she also was on the water board. She approved the permit to BP, and so when the Alliance for the Great Lakes came out on behalf of the uproar, public uproar, about this illegal permit, or this permit that was clear in violation of the Clean Water Act, they stepped forward and negotiated on behalf of the public a non-binding agreement that didn't bind them to anything and also didn't ask them to do much. Suddenly, Alliance of Great Lakes is saying, everything's fine. Everything's fine. Everything's just hunky-dory. What Rahm Emanuel got out of it was contracts. We had a $5 billion investment right here. He pulled contracts over into his constituencies. And that's what that whole uproar was about. And that's how environmental issues are leveraged for money, for contracts and stuff.
Well, they're co-opted. The public concern is co-opted because I think Illinois PERS was also involved. I mean, there were activists who actually understood the threat it presented, but then it was taken over by elite groups or major groups.
Right, and you also have the unions that will trade against the environment for jobs when they negotiate with industries. And a good example is here we have one major group called the Calumet Project. And everybody hears about the Calumet Project. Well, the full name of the Calumet Project is Calumet Project for Industrial Jobs. And what they'll often do is they'll step into an issue, an environmental issue, and then step away when they get what they want in terms of a contract for the union. And then suddenly the issue's gone. But they'll step into an environmental issue as a leveraging tool. And that becomes a huge problem in trying to solve our environmental issues here. And I can give you a tour around here.
Okay, you mentioned the Great Lakes, the Greater Great Lakes. Are you talking about with the Canadian concern? Like what are the Canadians? Now you've got the Canadian connection.
Right. The Great Lakes Commission. I actually sat on the Great Lakes Commission for a little bit as a...
Did they have to approve this too? The BP thing?
They know that it's occurring. One of the things that happens with these kinds of organizations, let me try to tell you. When the BP permit was what had been, they put out their application. What I ended up doing is I went to the Sierra Club, I went to Hoosier Environmental Council, and I went to the Save the Dunes, which is the major environmental group there in this area. I approached all three of them and said, what can we do to oppose this, to work against this? Each and every one of them stepped back and said, BP is a good company, this is their words, good company, and it's jobs. We're not going to step into this. Each one, I stepped forward in front of a train and got blown away. There wasn't any uproar, anybody speaking against this, and then certainly not the Great Lakes Commission. We're not speaking against this. This was something that was already, in terms of the good government initiative, those things were already solved. Those issues were already solved with all those entities through those negotiations.
And the permit we're talking about is for polluting the water?
Permit was their discharge into the waterways. Now, the way in which I look at discharges, whether it's in the air, land, or water, is that those are externalities. Those are financial externalities. And if we solve those, we solve a lot of the issues. I tend to put the onus of my challenge on those issues. Right now, the way in which we frame the work is that an industry is allowed to put toxins and pollutants into the air, water, and land. And people get to hear of the meetings or don't hear and have to chase after information to approve the risk to their lives and welfare or not to approve it or try to fight against it. They have to become experts in political negotiation and maneuvering. They have to become experts in toxicology, experts in environmental science, experts in so many areas that they aren't. We all have unfortunately, we all live within specialized society and we don't have that broad understanding, and we don't have access to it. I was going to show you so many things, but we got to get on this tour here.
Sorry.
I love all this stuff here, but there's a. Let's see, where is this? There's a. Maybe I missed it.
The heart of the community.
I missed it. Anyhow, oh, this is good. This is a picture outside my window. If you go on the third floor, this is the picture outside my window. But right now, in the United States, industry and corporations employ over 30,000 environmental lawyers.
Right.
Governments.
Not to protect the environment, but protect
they employ, they just employ. Government agencies employ less than 2,000 environmental lawyers, whether local government agencies or national. Nonprofits employ less than 600 government agencies. Now, nonprofits could be for industry or against industry, right? Citizens and communities employ less than 200 environmental lawyers. So those are the kinds, that's the kinds of scale of problems that we have. That's how we allocate resources in our country, and those kinds of, you know, legal resources to bring up challenges. And that has to do with this, that addresses the problems with our environmental regime and how we address our problems. We have allowed the industry to define those terms. When in the, and then they present to us, whether we can find out they're presenting it to us, if we can get to the meetings or not, whether we accept the risk or not, instead of putting the burden on them to not, for anything that they introduce to the, into the environment, to be non-toxic or non-hazardous, it should, burden should be on them if they're introducing something to the, into the environment, to prove that it's non-toxic and not hazardous. The problem is the burden is on us on the back end to prove what we've been in, you know,
to prove that there are bodies in the road,
that they've hurt us or hurt the environment. So those are the kinds of challenges we have, and that's becoming, that's going from, you know, it's kind of like medicine, you know, whether you're going to fix the harm or do preventive medicine. And right now we need to change our environmental regime to a preventive system. And what I call what Carolyn Ratzinger has been fighting for is the precautionary principle. And I think
which exists in the society. The Pentagon gets a bloated budget on that principle. They have to protect against the theoretical risks.
Right.
They don't have to prove that the risks are actually there.
That's true too, yeah. So there are lots of challenges. And what you see here, is that East Chicago basically has become a sacrifice zone to our industrial culture, our post-industrial culture. We're not a post-industrial in any means, but we have so much here that is just impacted. And basically, we move forward, and don't solve a lot of legacy issues. A good example right now is the industry, oil industry and nation states, First Nation states, are going to be faced with the legal impacts, liabilities of global climate change. We know that they're hoarding cash to, in the case that they're going to have to actually deal with them. Now, you saw at COP.
Who's hoarding cash? Large energy companies?
Yeah.
In case they get sued or...
In case they're having to deal with
a lot of this.
But the
liability
issue problem
being discussed at the international climate change.
Yes.
Right. And yeah, that's where the ambassador of the Philippines stood up and said, what we're negotiating here is who's going to die and who isn't. That's what we're at. Because the First Nations, or not First Nations, First Nations sounds like the indigenous cultures, but the First World Nations walked away. They weren't going to talk about reparations and how to deal with those issues. They kind of walked away from the Third World.
Harm.
The harm.
Dealing with harm.
Yeah. And so what we have here, a good example is, in 1995, BP discharged 16.8 million gallons of crude into our water table. It's floating on our water. Now, we've heard about all these. You heard about the biggest oil spill in North America, inland oil spill. That was the tar sands in the Kalamazoo River. That was 1 million gallons. There's 16 million gallons sitting in our water table right here on the shores of Lake Michigan. Nobody's ever talked about
it. In the water table?
Yes, right here.
Wow.
And what happened in 1995 is it started bubbling up into the basements of people.
Wow.
In the neighborhoods. Those residents sued BP and lost because they couldn't prove that it was from BP, they said. Nobody has ever, there's no plans to ever remediate that. In fact, right now they're right on just to the west of us is the Gary Airport. They're expanding it. And as they were expanding it, they found another 1 million gallons of oil contaminating the soil there. And nobody identifies who's responsible for it. There's no identifying it, even though there's pipelines running through there that you can figure that out. That's just the environmental regime, you know, the pecking order, the order of things. So let's get our coats. Unfortunately, I'm afraid my car is probably cold again. I warmed it up right before you guys got here.